Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 664 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and EAA AirVenture Oshkosh 2021 has come and gone. This week, we bring you additional coverage of the event. All right, here's what we have this episode. Hillel Glaser, Airplane Geeks Innovation and Entrepreneurship Correspondent, speaks with the Senior Vice President of the National Air Transportation Association on the role of the association, the market, the challenges, and opportunities. NATA represents airports, FBOs, and other aviation businesses and services with an emphasis on local, rural, and general aviation interests and benefits in aviation. Next, Hillel speaks with Tetra Aviation to discuss their vision for eVTOL and urban air mobility, as well as their current product, which they brought to Oshkosh. Tetra is the winner of the Pratt & Whitney Disruptor Prize in the Go Fly Prize competition awarded in February 2020. This is a great example of how competition can bring new participants with out-of-the-box ideas to create new markets. Then, some aviation podcasters assembled for what has been the annual gathering called Podapalooza. That event at Oshkosh has been organized by different people over the years, most recently by Airplane Geeks reporter-at-large Launchpad Merzari. With his tragic passing, many podcasters and others wanted to get together to say something about our friend Brad. So we want to thank Pipistrel Aircraft for letting us use their booth space for this Podapalooza. And then finally, this episode, EAA Radio broadcasts from Oshkosh during AirVenture, and I was interviewed for a segment. We'll play that, and we'd like to thank EAA Radio for making the recording available. But before we get started, we have some statistics from AirVenture. Attendance this year was approximately 608,000. That's the third time attendance has surpassed 600,000, and it's within 5% of 2019's record total. More than 10,000 aircraft arrived at Whitman Regional Airport in Oshkosh and other airports in East Central Wisconsin. At Whitman alone, there were 16,378 aircraft operations in the 10-day period from July 22nd to 31st, 2021. That's approximately 116 average takeoffs and landings per hour when the airport is open. The 3,176 show planes included 1,420 vintage aircraft registered, plus 1,089 home-built aircraft, 354 warbirds, 148 aerobatic aircraft, 112 seaplanes, 33 ultralights, and 27 rotorcraft. More than 12,000 sites in aircraft and drive-in camping accounted for an estimated 40,000 visitors. Now, get ready for this. More than 5,000 volunteers contributed in excess of 250,000 hours. As for exhibitors, there were 747 commercial exhibitors. There were 1,055 forums, workshops, and presentations. And despite travel restrictions, there were visitors from 66 countries. There were also 567 media representatives on site, and they came from four continents. So it's a large, large event, and we'll talk some more about that, I think, in the future. But let's get started with the segments that we have for this episode. We'll start with Hillel Glaser, with the Senior Vice President of the National Air Transportation Association.
This is Hillel Glaser, Innovation and Entrepreneurship Correspondent for the Airplane Geeks Podcast, coming to you from Oshkosh AirVenture 2021. I'm here with Ryan Wagspach, Senior Vice President of the National Air Transportation Association, and I will let Ryan tell you what that is all about. Ryan, thank you for coming to the podcast, and welcome to Oshkosh.
Thank you, Hillel. What an honor to speak with everyone today. Again, for those who are not familiar with the National Air Transportation Association, we've been around a little over 80 years, and we represent the businesses within the business aviation platform. So FBOs, air charter operators, repair stations, flight schools, and a growing segment is airports. And I've been with the organization as an executive for a little over 3.5 years. Been in the industry for a little over 20 years. So it's been a fantastic experience as we advocate and work for the general aviation and private aviation community.
Interesting. So you're probably several things, part lobbyist, part association, kind of bringing people together, doing things in a group that individuals can't do. So tell us the kind of stuff that you're working on these days.
Yeah, so, you know, what's been really interesting is we've really been focusing in post-pandemic on how general aviation and private aviation play in very key strategic roles for our communities. We started an initiative late July of last year called the General Aviation Advancing America Tour, where we really went out and promoted airports and infrastructure. And what we found, Hillel, was fascinating. We found that the general aviation community was blossoming in these in these rural communities, in these non-139 fields. The pandemic really showcased that you don't have to live in Metroplex areas anymore. You can live wherever you want. You just need a means of transportation to either get to a hub or get out to, you know, to an airport and be able to run around professionally or privately for your business. The one of the best stories that I remember hearing was a local FBO walked in, was speaking with the leaders. They said, we had a gentleman come out here, and he said, I'm looking for a blue and a white, I believe it's a 182. I don't know. And of course, the FBO manager was a little confused, and he said, sir, what can I, you know, what's going on? He goes, well, I just bought it. Never laid eyes on it, but I have full intentions to train, become current, you know, train, get to become certified, and be able to use it privately and for my professional growth and my business. So it's been fascinating to see how this has evolved for our industry.
That's, you know, those kind of anecdotes are often the thing that you are hearing as indicative of major changes in an industry. They wouldn't happen if the industry was the way it always has been. You know, people would never buy planes sight unseen and not current and so on. So, and you kind of cracked the eggshell on that. You started talking about post-pandemic. But so transition us from pre-pandemic, during pandemic, and now post-pandemic, and what kind of things has that done for what you've seen in the overall industry, maybe at first and then now? And if any way, how has the National Air Transportation Association had to make adjustments to meet those different conditions that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, you know, fat, dumb, and happy, then uncertainty, and then, whoa, what's going on? You know, what did that do for you guys?
So let's go back pre-pandemic, right? The private aviation, you know, the general aviation scene was fairly flat, right? Fairly flat growth. There was a little bit of transition, but it was based on innovation, right, within the OEM space, and that's what was really evolving products. You know, the FBOs were doing what FBOs do. The flight training facilities were, you know, we were coming into a significant pilot shortage then, and they were trying to work on innovative ways of getting new recruits in. Coming to the pandemic, as you pointed out, massive uncertainty. We had to relook at how we do business, right? How does an FBO interact with an aircraft owner or charter operator or operator, period, right? How do you buy fuel? What's the cleanliness? So we developed with our Safety First Committee Safety Clean Standard, which was based on keeping an FBO to a higher level of cleanliness. We looked at new ways of engaging air and ground ops. And what this has really done is kicked down the door of engaging how air and ground communicate, because historically those two really haven't engaged much. Fast forward as we emerge out of the pandemic, knocking on wood right now, that we don't have any setbacks, but it's been an exacerbation of a focus on growth in our industry. Now, how do we maintain that growth? We're seeing a tremendous amount of stickiness within the private aviation scene, historic highs in charter activity, historic lows in inventory, People can't buy aircraft quick enough. So how do we maintain that, and how do we mature our industry and grow as we emerge out of this pandemic? It's going to be really interesting to watch. And NATA, it continues to play an active role in communicating and advocating for all of the general aviation community to communicate. We got to collaborate together to keep this ball moving forward.
Indeed. So who else besides FBOs? I mean, who are the organizations that, for lack of a better term, buy into NATA to support, fund, like, whose agendas do you carry, especially when there's so much variety in the constituencies, right? You know, an FBO, certain FBOs are probably going to look at you and say, you know, actually, you're supporting our competitors. And they may not look at it. That may be wrong, but that's what they might think, you know. So you've got several roles. One is to get everybody on the same page and moving in the same direction. But then you want folks to come and be part of the organization and you know, understand that collectively we're stronger than individually.
Yeah, and that's a great question. You know, when we're all toting the line, as we've all heard, that is the key here. We've got numerous committees that work together, collaborate on industry challenges. You know, we've got air charter operators that are focused on how do they maintain in the regulatory space, right? They're also focused in on with our flight training committees on how do we continue to develop the next generation of pilots. Working with our maintenance committee, we have to have AMPs and technicians, right? We may eventually take a pilot out of the cockpit, but these machines are still going to break. We need the technicians to continue to fix these machines. Another area of collaboration is a growing segment is airports, right? When we are able to create healthy ecosystems, whether that's airport, FBO, operator, flight school, it wins for everybody. It's a very win-win. And that's what we're striving for.
So I might summarize that as saying that you're in the business of creating a co-opetition, like you're cooperating and competing in the same group of people because, you know, the rising tide raises all boats kind of concept.
That's exactly right. We continue to hear the term, we're all frenemies, right? I hate that term, but it's true, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. Frenemies is an excellent term, actually. Where do you see the biggest opportunities and maybe new opportunities that didn't exist before, let alone the opportunities that have always been there? There's threats, there's strengths, there's weaknesses in the industry and in the field. And what needs to be done next? Like, what could somebody really do right now, take advantage of potentially a big hockey stick in the industry or something? What do you see there?
Yeah, we see a tremendous amount of opportunity in the public-private partnerships with airports. You know, airport growth and infrastructure and hangar builds. We saw, private money developing almost like a country club with hangars, right? Where, you know, men and women can host their aircraft. They have a place to hang out. They're investing in the airport. They're investing in the community. Those are a lot of these key areas where the private equity is flooding into the business and, you know, the private aviation market because they are very bullish on it. And, you mentioned innovation. Innovation's key is going to be key in the success, right? We've got a lot of environmental challenges ahead of us, whether that's noise, whether that's, you know, lead, whether that's, just plain and simple fuel. We've got a lot of fantastic things that are currently working and in the pipeline. We need to continue to push. We need to continue to push the infrastructure. One of the interesting things that's coming down is, of course, the electrical grid, right, and getting electrical power to airports. You know, whether that's for the electrical motors for training or eventually VTOL, we will have to see. But I think that's an area of focus and we'll continue to grow and see great strides in.
That's fascinating because I was just about to go in that direction to talk about some of the challenges, you know, in the aviation industry and some of the things that come up when we talk about aviation. It's not some of the things, it comes up all the time, is regulation. Does the NATA play a role in regulation? How do you fit in?
Sure. Yeah, we are heavily involved with the FAA and working with the FAA and all the regulators on issues that are facing the general aviation, private aviation scene. You know, one of our key initiatives, of course, is illegal charter, right? Combating illegal flight operations as it's a risk for safety in the skies. We know there's a lot of ways that we need to be innovative and move that needle as, you know, pilots need to getting to their ATP and becoming more qualified. Aircraft, we understand these aircraft are expensive to operate, right? But working with the regulators to simplify and work to simplify adhering to the regs is key, right? If we're stuck in 1968 with the dot matrix printer, right, this is kind of one of the challenges that some of our regulator friends are having challenges with moving forward.
So obviously aviation covers a broad footprint, and there's so many different angles. It might almost be easier to ask you what don't you get into than what you are into, but let's just get a sense of scope. How big is the NATA staff? Is it all in Washington? Is it spread around the country? Well, now that we can work anywhere we want, it may not, maybe 20 months ago it was all in Washington, but before 20 months ago, what was your footprint? How big is the organization, and maybe what don't you get into?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So prior to pandemic, we were mostly based in D.C. We still have a significant footprint on Connecticut with our office and staff. But like I live in Birmingham, Alabama. I travel. I'm on the road constantly bumping. I want to keep focused on Main Street, what's happening. I don't want to live in a glass bubble and try to make assumptions and what's taking place and what needs to happen in the D.C. Beltway. So that keeps me very active and on the road. Our support staff's around 25, and it's fairly small for what we do. You know, I'm trying to think, what do we not touch in the private aviation world? I mean, yeah, that's a tough one. Because we understand there's so many elements, and associations work together, right? We work together and collaborate.
So with so much out there you could be doing, how do you prioritize what you were going to work on? Is it an annual? Is it this is the hottest fire, we have to do this right now? Or this piece of legislation is about to destroy aviation, let's drop everything and deal with that? Or you know, how do you figure out, well, this is what we can deal with because this is the resources we have and these are the priorities? Either who or how do you determine what you're going to be focusing on for however long you have to focus on it?
Yeah, from the legislative area, that's a great point, right? Sometimes we do have to drop everything because sometimes, just like this infrastructure bill, right? One minute they've just got bullets, 2 days later they're trying to vote on it. We're trying, and D.C.'s not what it used to be, trying to get in and understand what's taking place, where the bill's language is being written from, et cetera. So that plays a huge role in how quickly we have to adapt. From the other side of the point, it's what our committees. We are a committee-driven organization, so what they prioritize, we prioritize. And that's what drew me out of the industry, was I was frustrated being in the industry for 24 years and saying, who's advocating for us? Like, who is taking what I need and saying, I need this to work? And that's why we do numerous town halls all over the country, you know, multiple times a year in all areas. And we want to listen, and then we want to take it back to our committees. And they prioritize where we put our focus on.
So your committees are obviously not made up of employees. They're made up of people in the industry and the different focus groups and that kind of stuff. So they're volunteers. Right. So you've got corporate volunteers or other types of volunteers, which is that makes a lot of sense. When you are out there and you're looking at what areas are or aren't doing with aviation to benefit themselves, let me give you a story and maybe it'll help explain. Where I live, unfortunately, too many areas don't take advantage of the fact that they have an airport. And in many, many places, as you well know, there's a lot of people who bought a house when there was an airport there. They knew there was an airport there and then suddenly don't like their airport there.
That's right. And
on top of that, the local community, the local government doesn't do anything to promote use of the airport as an economic engine. So, you know, when I once pulled into an airport just because I needed gas and it was VFR and I could land there a long time ago, I was just stunned that the FBO was decked out in a way to promote the area they were in. They were just completely like promoting themselves. They had conference rooms. They had all kinds of stuff to make the airport a place that business would come to have business. How does NATA, if at all, work with communities to get them to understand why you don't want to close the airport? You know, Santa Monica being a terrible example of how that failed miserably, and I'm not saying that it has anything to do with the organization. But there's clearly that was something that couldn't be stopped, and the right people weren't in the right places to make it stop. But what does NATA do?
So let's go back to our General Aviation Advancing America Tour, right? It's, to your point, we have to showcase, we have to communicate what these airports do for our communities, that these airports are the front door to our community. The pandemic not only allowed that to showcase, right, whether it was vaccine distribution, PPE, testing, also job creation, economic development. So we went out and we did tour, and we're continuing this tour. We're going out, we bring local leaders together, we bring the airport together, we showcase what the airport is, right, and what it's capable of doing. We try to focus in on kind of airports that are, you know, more maybe communities don't necessarily understand it, right? Or local leadership doesn't understand it. Why do we invest so much in this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? So we go out and we want to highlight really what that airport's doing for that community. And that's continued. Like I said, I visited, you know, dozens and dozens of airports last year in 2020 during the height of the pandemic, and will continue throughout this year and beyond. I think that's crucial. Because it is. It sometimes can very easily get a black eye, and people don't recognize what it's capable of doing.
So on that note, it sounds like if you know, you're not an airline and you are not in that supply chain deeply, and you're more on the every other way of flying that's not airline flying, and you want to get involved in some way, that you could possibly find a committee or something to do with NATA. Somebody wants to do that. How do they do that?
Go to nata.aero. It's our website, and you can look me up, and happy to reach out, and I'd love to speak with you and hear your insight or hear your challenges in your area.
What is coming to Oshkosh, the Air Venture, because you could always come to Oshkosh for something else, I guess, but what is coming to Oshkosh, the Air Venture, do for NATA?
It allows us to see our members and get out and see. You know, we walk over there by the static, right? And the majority of those aircraft were civil servants, right? Civil-like type of aircraft providing a mission, right? Whether it's ocular, right, the eye surgery or the military. I mean, it was truly, it was good to see, and I think that's good to highlight.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Ryan. Like Ryan said, you want to get involved with NATA to get even more in front of some of the issues with your local airport or working with businesses and FBOs and everything else that's not airline transport. We love our airline transports, but, you know, we don't all get to use them all the time. They don't do everything for us. Please contact Ryan at the National Air Transportation Association at nata.aero. Thanks so much, Ryan, for joining us on the Airplane Geeks. Have a great rest of your air venture.
Thank you.
Here's Hillel and Tetra Aviation.
I'm Hillel Glazer, the innovation and entrepreneurship correspondent for the Airplane Geeks podcast, and again, coming to you from Air Venture in Oshkosh 2021. I am here with Tetra. They are a company out of Japan, and I'd like to introduce you to Tatsuki Nakai, the CEO, Hidemi Arai, a director, and Koya Kawamura, one of the engineers. So first, Tatsuki, can you tell me a little bit about the company? How long has the company been around? And really, why did you start the company? Or what's the purpose of being here?
Right. We're focusing on a transportation network for more people. And we started this company since 3 years ago. Then I first participated in the GoFly Prize, which is sponsored by Boeing. And we honored for a disruptive prize for $100,000 first. Then afterward, we tried to make more people involved in the transportation in air. So we make a Mark 5 that's another eVTOLs to present this air venture, then try to make people transported in 100 miles away for every people living in urban or rural anywhere and to any places.
So for those of you who are not going to go look at the show notes or pictures, what we're looking at here is clearly what is an eVTOL-type aircraft with 32 rotors on four pylons of eight each. The pylons are attached to what appear to be wings, because they are airfoils with flaps or ailerons, and tricycle landing gear, and a pusher prop as well. So this is clearly something meant to fly in short spaces, land and take off without a lot of runway. But this prototype obviously only has one person capable in it, if there were to be any people at all. But the idea is pretty sound. It looks a lot like a real airplane, only with a big canard with props on the front on the left, and another wing that's further back that's bigger. So the main wing, in fact, would you think is a high wing. So it's kind of a really funky biplane. You really ought to go to the show notes and take a look at the pictures. And just to clarify, you started this about 3 years ago, and you won the Disruptor Award from the Boeing. What was the name of the contest?
The contest was Go Fly Prize.
The Go Fly Prize?
Yep.
Yeah, that's pretty big deal. Congratulations on
that.
So what is the, you know, you're talking about, it's not just urban air mobility. You're looking at getting to the airport from different places. Ultimately, what is the first type of product that you think you're going to have? Like, what is the use of that first product? I'm sure 20 years from now, you'd be happy to have something that takes 12 people. That's probably not going to be your first product, right? So what's the first product you're working on?
I'm looking for a customer who are willing to use this as a kind of recreational or a part of their life to move from their backyard to anywhere they're willing to. So this is for only recreational use case at first, but gradually is spread to the more common transportation network.
Are you looking at this to be piloted by qualified pilots or semi-autonomous, where you basically tell it, I want to go here, and the plane does everything for the passengers?
Finally, we wanted to fly this as a full autonomous flight with only the customers or passengers. But for now, depending on the restrictions, we have an experimental aircraft. So we wanted to have the private pilot license at first, then gradually make it to a semi-autonomous and a fully autonomous.
So that seems to be the pathway that many of the products are going. It's like start out with somebody that knows what they're doing in the cockpit and eventually work their way toward people that don't know anything but push the button on, and you know they might know how to program their GPS, but that's it. Yeah, that's how it's going. So what's really impressive is that 3 years ago is when you started, and you've already got a completely fabricated prototype of some sort that can this machine right here fly?
Yes, this machine is going to fly, and we're going to hold a test at California next month, middle of the August to the September. We wanted to certify it as experimental aircraft, as a horizontal flight and vertical flight both. So this is a actual working prototype.
Have all of you been with the company since it started?
Yes, I was also the co-founder, and I was working with Tatsuki for 3 years. And yeah, it was a great day for us, because there are no Japanese company that actually build aircraft, and there are no company that are actually building the eVTOL in that age. So it was a quite great days, and I have enjoying the Oshkosh right now very much.
What made you come to Oshkosh? Have you been here before?
This is the first time to come here to Oshkosh AirVenture for the first time. So we never been here, and we only came for a GoFly Prize the last year held at the California. So this is the first time for that, and this is a very amazing experience.
Whose idea was it to come to Oshkosh? Did you hear about Oshkosh before you got into this, and you just knew you had to come, or was there something that you wanted to accomplish by coming to Oshkosh?
We know Oshkosh because in a couple years ago, Honda Jet revealed their first prototype at Oshkosh. And like engineer knew Oshkosh very much, and they knew that there will be the pilot and engineers. And we wanted to have a feedback from them. So we choose like a Honda Jet. We choose to come to the Oshkosh to show our prototype and get several feedback from the users and the pilots.
Has that been working well for you? Are you getting good feedback from people that are you know, trying to ask you questions? Is this being productive for you?
Yes, very much. And they give us a great feedback of our prototypes.
This obviously doesn't fit in an ordinary vehicle, and I don't think you're going to hire a military cargo plane to bring it like this. This must break down into something that you can transport. How long does it take you to build it from its parts? Like, how did you get it here? I mean, we're looking at a complete aircraft that you didn't fly here from Japan, and you didn't put it in a cargo plane from Japan, like a military size. Just like this aircraft, how long does it take to go from boxes to this?
So we reassemble this aircraft in a half a day. So the wing is detachable, and also the vertical horizontal unit. A vertical unit is also detachable. So those parts were removed, and we packed in the box and shipped from Japan.
Do any of you have an aviation background? I mean, what got you? Why did you choose to create an aircraft to go into the aviation business? Do you have backgrounds in aviation or business, or what's the background that made you come up with this as a business? And we'll talk about why this type of solution as a second question. What's the background that made you get into this very competitive market?
All right. I don't have any backgrounds in the aviation industry, but I have a mechanical engineer. I myself think this is a next generation of a transportation network, and this could be involve more people than usual. I mean, not more for a common airman, but also all the industries. So I choose to this industry make more common in both Japan and the United States. Then in Japan, there's very few people who are working on the aviation industry. So we're working on it to foster this industry more in Japan and the United States.
What is it that has changed in your observation over the last few years to bring so many non-aviation business people into the aviation market? Because you're not the only one that we've heard that from, that they just see an opportunity and they want to fill it with a solution, but they don't have a background in aviation. Something must have changed in aviation to bring non-aviation people into aviation. Something changed. What was that in your observation that changed to get you into aviation?
Most of the part is the possibility. I feel that the possibility of this industry, but we proved that we could do so because we prized by the Boeing's and Pratt & Whitney for a disruptive price, and this will allow us to move faster and more on this industry. And of course, we have a motivation that we wanted to move more faster and quicker and easier in a general transportation network.
So it sounds like when the opportunity came to you through the competition, that you saw, hey, they're giving away money for people who can solve a problem. Let's go try to solve it and see how we do. And you obviously did very well. Why do you think you won? Like, why did you come up with this design, and why do you think you won the competition with this design, coming from a completely not aviation background, which I will point out is not unusual for people outside an industry to come up with the disruptive technologies and solutions. That's normal. Congratulations for proving that right. But what do you think? Why do you think you won?
So the prize-winning design is not this. So we have a previous model that's more like a personal hover bike, and we won that. And I think we won because we had not much background, but we think about from the first principle, and we built it as a ground up, and it was an initial thing, and that was like a more imaginary thing. And we were we gathered the talented people, and we could build a concept and just fly it. So I think that was the reason we won. So that was the more like an imaginary thing, but we were able to build because we gathered the talented people. And by such a great team, we could win that prize.
I love the validation of the whole innovation ecosystem where they start out with a prize, you build something that is mostly an idea, And then, but because you won, you're able to turn that idea into something real that's based on just the initial concept. The initial concept was not what you were obviously going to commercialize, but it gave you a boost to commercialization from, you know, from winning the prize, which was just to demonstrate the technology that would be disruptive. And here it is proving you right. What are your immediate goals? You said you want to get experimental certification, or sort of not really the right word, but you want to build an actual experimental aircraft next. And then after that, what comes up next?
We wanted to sell this aircraft as a kit plane for next year. After that, we got a certification and certified in FAA and NCAT list. Then afterwards, we want to try to make it a Part 23 certification for the mass production, or depending on the conditions, a light sport aircraft. And we wanted to sell this aircraft for customers who are willing to participate in the service or own itself, and all the people who are interested in our aircraft.
Is the first aircraft going to be a single pilot, single user, or is it going to be like basically what we see here, or is it going to be multiple, like one a pilot plus a passenger, or what's the first aircraft that you want to certify as a kit?
First, we are willing to make it as a single seat, because in the end, the full autonomous flight, there's no need to have a pilot for the passengers. So we designed a single seat aircraft at focusing on, but depending on the customer's request, we can make it the two seaters for a tandem or a aligned way to produce their customer's will.
That's great. Let's get into some of the things that people that might use it experience. How far, how high, how fast, how much time in the air. Those are the things that whenever anybody hears battery-powered electric motors, that they all want to know what kind of batteries, how long does it take to charge, how long does it last, how far can I go? Those are the obvious questions that if you don't have good enough answers, no one's going to buy, you know, to fly around their own house. So what can you tell us about the expected performance parameters?
So the range will be 100 mile, and flight time is 1 hour, and cruising speed will be 100 mile per hour. So that's 1 hour flight.
So that sounds pretty square, 100, 100, 1 hour. Okay, and how long will it take to charge the batteries to do that 1 hour, do you think, right now?
So right now it's about 2 or 3 hours.
I mean, 0 to 100.
It depends on the use case.
Right. And does it require any kind of special power connections or whatever? Can you just, infrastructure, or do you just go to any FBO and plug into the wall?
Oh, we designed it for just plug it in the wall, the conventional electrical content out there. It depending on if you have any fast charger for the car, we can design for those for customers who have that connector.
I'm saying this as a joke, but maybe not so much. You might first put your aircraft on display in the Tesla dealer.
Hey, it's better to do that. I mean, if Elon is interested in our company, he's very happy to have this, to present this aircraft. May change the transportation network. He worries about it. And we, in Japan, we have a Hyperloop kind of things, because we have very large number of the subway run through the city of Tokyo, but its congestion is never solved in our country. So we have to discuss it about to use the aviation industry with us to speak with the Tesla's CEO.
So you hear that, Elon? If they're looking for help and they're looking for people that know what they're doing. So in case you're listening, which I don't think he does, we all listen to Elon, but does Elon listen to us? I don't know. But anyhow, but if you are, they'd love to talk to you. Like, what else would you like to tell us about the company? Is there anything that I haven't asked or you haven't shared that you want us to know about Tetra Aviation, or anything that you want to talk about?
All right. We're looking for hiring for the engineer in the United States and also the investor in the United States as well, because we wanted to get involved with many people to this industry in the United States and in Japan to make more common for many people to this industry and the eVTOL transporting network. So we're willing to have the engineers or any salesman, any person is possible for coming and join our company and as an investor participating in our company to make our vision come true.
So again, you're an investor and or an engineer or someone who can help this company get off the ground, pun almost somewhat intended, in the United States, please contact them through the information that we're going to put on the website. And is the best place to reach you through www.tetra-aviation.com?
Yes, this is the best way to contact with us. Please text your name and email address and why you are willing to participate in our website.
Great. Well, I want to thank you all for being on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, from Oshkosh Air Venture 2021, this is Hillel Glazer. Bye for now.
Next for you is this year's version of Potapalooza.
All right, everyone. My name is Ken Viard. Myself, like most everyone here, Brad Launchpad Mazzari was a very dear friend and had a huge impact on my life. And I know everyone here Brad has touched, or otherwise you would not be here. Oshkosh, as other air shows, was one of Launchpad's most favorite places. That's where he really grew even taller than he was and grew even bigger than he was. And I wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to gather and remember Launchpad. I, for one, don't even want to admit that he's no longer with us. He's still with me. And what I just hope that we would do today is spend a little time remembering Launchpad here at the Pippenstroll booth, where he hosted his Potapalooza every year here. And I know it killed him that EAA was not going to allow him to host it here this year. So, if anything, we got it done. Yeah. We got Potapalooza done this year for Brad, and I know he's up there smiling over that. Hopefully, anybody who wants to, I just want to take turns, talk about how Brad touched your life or a Launchpad story. I'm sure there's at least one or two in the group here, and keep it simple. This is about remembering Brad. He's still with us. His legacy will live on for far longer than I'll be around, and I'm so thankful to have met him several years ago. Actually, right here in this booth is where I met Launchpad for the first time. So I remember it's about the second or third year I came up to Oshkosh. I had an open seat in a Bonanza, and Brad quickly took it. And flying up here, it was a miserable flight. It was hot. It was one of those summers where it was hot all the way. I think once you get about 30 miles south of Oshkosh, the temperature dropped. I remember flying over St. Louis. And in this airplane, we had to change airplanes at the last minute because my plane had a maintenance issue, and one of my friends let me fly his VTOL up. So it's a borrowed airplane now. And I remember Brad opening the window. It's placarded. Don't open over a certain speed. We're way over that speed. But he says, I can't let it get hot in here. I've got chocolates. So we worked out a rotation of about 15, 20 minutes on, 15, 20 minutes off. And the whole way, Brad could not sit idle. I don't know if anybody's ever seen Brad do nothing. He's doing things when he sleeps. So up, we had to come up with ground rules of a line on the panel of where he can touch and what was me as the pilot to fly. So we made it up here. Way down in North Fond du Lac is where we ended up parking, trying to figure out how to get all of our gear up here. But we made it up. And then on the departure out of here, I remember his whole thing was being announced by a podcast to see as we went. He was trying to tune in on his iPhone to hear the live cast, to hear, oh, there's Brad, there's one Charlie Victor taking off. I believe it was UCAP that was doing it, doing that live broadcast. And that just made his day, hearing him flying. Because I think I don't quote me on this, it might have been his first time actually flying into Oshkosh on the Fisk approach. And having that experience with Brad, double-edged sword, being locked in an airplane for almost 10 hours with Brad has its challenges, but it's still something that I'm always going to take with me, that we got to do that flight together. So, Brad, thank you for everything. Who would like to go next?
Thanks, Ken. Hi, I'm Jim Goldman with the Uncontrolled Airspace Podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm going to talk about Brad rather than Launchpad because I knew him long before he adopted that nom de plume for podcast use, and I met Brad in Florida at Sun and Fine when we were hanging out there as fans of the Uncontrolled Airspace Podcast. And who knows when it was, but it had to be 10 years ago, roughly. 8, 9, something like that. So a couple of quickies. I spent a lot of time talking with Brad by sitting next to him in the cockpit of one of these pipistrels, on display, because that way we could talk as long as we wanted and everybody thought he was working. It was great. We weren't talking about pipistrel. Sorry, guys. But he did show me the airplane, but we talk about everything else. And Brad's the kind of guy who's headstrong, right? We all know this. And it was great to butt heads with him because I like disagreeing with people who are knowledgeable. It makes it interesting and you learn. And I respected his knowledge, especially warbirds, which is not my specialty, but general aviation in general. And we also butted heads occasionally because in his enthusiasm, and I think, Ken, you hinted at this, his enthusiasm sometimes got the better of him. He would come up with ideas that were great, but just not practical. And I just love these memories of the guy. So I wanted to share those with you. Thank you. And who's next?
Hello, everybody. I'm Nicholas Tupper. I'm probably better known around here as FOD. This story actually comes, I think, from the year I got that call sign, or maybe the year or two after. But I got that call sign because most of the time while I was at Oshkosh for the first several years, I've been coming since, 2006? So this is like year 13 for me. And that whole time, 90% of the time, you'd find me sitting behind one of the walls at Potapalooza or at a tie-down party, especially back when we did them at Sennheiser, just sitting there playing with whatever, toy soldiers, little model airplanes. I just spread crap all over the ramp. It was what I did. That's why they call me FOD. So one year back at the Sennheiser booth, they had the flight sim set up, doing Microsoft Flight Simulator. I spent some time there. I was a kid. I was 12. That's what I did. Eventually, I grabbed my little bag of stuff that I bought that day, because my dad was kind enough to get me a little kit with an ME-109 and a P-51. And I walked over, found a nice corner, sat down, got the kit out, and started putting these little model airplanes together. And I eventually get to this point where I'm just kind of at a standstill. I've put all the pieces together, but they came with these little paints that you had to mix with water and these little decals that you had to put on with a pair of tweezers. So I'm just kind of sitting there looking stumped, and all of a sudden this towering launch pad walks up behind me and says, "Hey, what you doing there?" And as we mentioned, he's a warbird guy, so we had a couple of little talks about the P-51 and about the 109, and eventually it got to the question of, "So what are you stumped on? Why haven't you finished yet?" And just, "Oh, I gotta mix some water with these paints and these little decals are kind of a pain. I've never put these on before." So then Launchpad disappears. I just turn, "Where'd he go?" 5 minutes later, he walks back up with a cup of water for the paint and decals and a handful of chocolates, and we both sit there crisscross applesauce like school children putting these little airplanes together. And I think I was in fifth or sixth grade when that happens, and I still remember it today. Thank you.
If anyone was wondering when they fought after, I'm sure Launchpad took the ME-109. I'm Steve Tupper. My call sign's Dogbag. You know me from the Airspeed podcast, and have listened long and hard and, frankly, with some jealousy about the stuff that Launchpad's been able to do and other social media. But he was always of the opinion that those kinds of things made the whole media space and, indeed, general aviation stronger. A thing Ken said earlier that I kind of wished he had said, I think it was Ken who said it, didn't say it on the mic, but I'm going to say it now because I think it's just the smartest thing I think anybody's ever said at Oshkosh. The experiences that we have with Launchpad are extraordinarily common. An act of kindness with a kid putting together a model kit. The chocolates. Always the chocolates. He gained object permanence for Fod and me after Potapalooza. This is even before the tie-down party, I think. When he said, hey, can you give me a ride back to where I'm staying? A half hour later, we arrived way north of Oshkosh where there was the house where he was staying, and then, you know, found our way back. That's when he sort of gained object permanence. He was otherwise a force of the place that wandered in and out among the landing gear and up and down Celebration Way. The thing that struck me, I texted with Launchpad the week before. He found out I was going to be in Dallas for a thing, and he was covering an avionics seminar. He cared enough to track you. Okay, it's stalking. He cared enough to track you and to say, hey, if you've got time while you're in town. And in fact, I was at a Lane Partners meeting in San Antonio. He shows up in the Porsche. We go to Denny's, and he's furiously working on his phone to try to get one of the aircraft to actually fly. He did, in fact, try to sell me one of these aircraft and worked hard at it because I'm a motor glider guy as well as a lot of other stuff. The thing that I think we find about Launchpad, and I'm not saying don't tell your story about the chocolates. Tell your story about the chocolates. I'm not saying don't tell your story about standing here and having those conversations. The phone rings at 10 p.m. You're tired, but it's Launchpad. And you hang up at midnight 30 or even after, feeling like that's a well-spent 2.5 hours and you don't know where it went. Those are common among we Launchpad's friends. These are the kinds of effects that he has had, and this is the kind of mark he made. It's been 2 years since we've been able to be back at Oshkosh. We all missed each other anyway. We miss Brad. So somebody take this.
I'm Dave Pasco. Some of you know me from Live ATC. Some of you know me from air shows. I probably met Launchpad, it's got to be 10 or 11 years ago. And it was chocolates. That was the first thing. And I thought, who is this guy? It's like larger than life. You know, it's been said many times. The thing that I most remember and I most treasure about Launchpad is really the, I'm going to say, the high dynamic range conversations that we had. Obviously, a lot of you know he was in Germany. Spent some time on assignment doing a bunch of stuff in Europe years ago, so we would talk about that. Just everything from Young Eagles to travel to, you know, a lot of aviation stuff, obviously, but mostly it would just roam from subject to subject, and nothing was off limits. And it was always interesting. It was always interesting. It was always fun. I learned something every single time. And I thought, I wish I could really be like this guy. To me, he was just unbelievable. And it didn't even matter where we were. We used to meet at different events. But just love the guy. Not much else to say, but gonna miss him. So.
I didn't know Brad quite the way some of you did, but I've known him for a long time. We met back in the 94, 95. We were together over in Europe, and the first time I met Brad, he came in to our exercise. We were exercise planners, and he came in with a broken arm. He had started his aviation career as a hang glider. That first day didn't end well. He's been a friend for a long, long time. I'm about an average size guy, and so I drive a Miata. But whenever he comes to air shows with us, he gets in the Miata. I don't know how he fits. But one of the things he's been great for is showing people just how much room are in our aircraft. About 4 years ago, we had a Taurus here, and Brad was going to show people that his 6'4" frame fit easily in that Taurus. He got in there and fell asleep, and he was in there for hours. We took pictures of him falling asleep. Yeah. He's been a good friend of mine, of Pipistrel, and of all of you. We'll sure miss him. The voice of reason has gone west.
Hi, I'm Max Flight from the Airplane Geeks podcast. And first, I'd like to thank Pipistrel for allowing us to use this space here at the Pipistrel booth to do this. It was actually at a Pipistrel booth that I met Launchpad for the first time, met him in person for the first time. He had been our reporter at large, we called him, for the podcast for some time. And I've learned just recently that there's some controversy over just who originated that term, reporter at large. But it doesn't matter. It fit perfectly. It fit physically. But it also described what he did for us. And Brad was always on the lookout for interviews, for content, for stories he could cover, constantly dreaming up sometimes harebrained ideas about who we could get onto the podcast. One in particular that just hasn't come to pass and won't now, obviously, is that there are, I think, 4 aircraft carriers that are on public display in the United States. I think it's 4. And what Launchpad wanted to do is get the director of each of those museums or organizations onto a round table all at the same time. Now, getting one of them scheduled, a person like that, getting one of those directors scheduled to come onto a podcast is a lot of work. To get all 4 of them at the same time on the same podcast, it's kind of a stretch, but for Launchpad, hey, no big deal. He just keeps doing what Launchpad did, and just through his personality, would just keep working that until it actually happened. But the first time I met him physically was at Sun and Fun, a couple of Sun and Funs ago, and he said, you got to fly in the Pipistrel. You got to go up. You got to go up. So he made an arrangement to get me into the motor glider, the Cenis, which was, like, phenomenal. I'd never been in the motor glider. The pilot asked me, he said, are you a pilot? And I said, no, I'm not a pilot. And he said, well, have you ever flown? And I said, no, I haven't flown. He says, all right, well, we'll start this slowly. And next thing you know, I'm soaring. He gives the command to me, where I'm soaring. He says, you've done this before, haven't you? And I said, no, this is really the first time I've ever flown an airplane. But describing to Launchpad that experience after I got out, got back and got out, I mean, he was just so happy that someone had been able to experience what I had been able to experience. And, I mean, obviously that's who he was, and particularly with young folks. And I've seen him in a conversation with somebody, and here comes some group or some family with some little kids, and he's like a magnet to them. And he brings them over, shows them the plane, he describes everything, gets them in the cockpit, tells them what they should know, tells them what they should be, avoid knowing. It was just amazing to watch him interact with young people like that. It's just, if we could do, if each of us could do half of that, that would just be a wonderful thing. So we're going to miss him. I'm not sure how he got onto the podcast, to tell you the truth. It If you've listened, but well, maybe you can kind of, if you've listened to the show for a while, you know, the co-hosts and contributors kind of come and go. It's sort of an evolving thing. It's not the same cast of characters throughout time. So sometimes it's kind of hard to tell when somebody starts to get involved. But with Launchpad, he just kept coming back with great stuff. It's like, well, let's get you on the show. And it just grew and grew. So I'm just really grateful to have known him and to take some things from him as examples that, you know, kind of point to ways that we all should act in life, treat life. If we can do a little bit of Launchpad ourselves, then we'd all be a lot better. So I miss him. All right, who's got something else? I want to put you on the spot.
So, despite the appearance, I'm not a Pipistrel representative. I'm just a customer. I help out occasionally. If I come up and fly up, I get to bunk with the Pipistrel crew and fun stuff like that. And so, Brad's always our. He called himself the Booth Babe. I didn't call him that. We would wipe down airplanes in the morning, get the dew off and stuff like that. And then one day he says, "Well, you going to the tie down party?" "What? What's a tie down party?" And he introduced me to you guys. And my life's not been the same since, and I appreciate all that you guys do—the content and the love of aviation that you share with your programs, all of you. And our life is going to be poorer without Brad there. But life goes on, and. That's it.
So Mike Harris with the Why We Fly podcast. And to me, the best thing, my favorite thing, and his lasting contribution is just his energy and enthusiasm for all things aviation. Just, you know, he just eats, sleeps, and breathes aviation and just loved to share his enthusiasm with young people, with old people, anybody that would listen. He just would love to talk your ear off about anything aviation, and just that energy and enthusiasm and his work through the podcast is really a lasting legacy. And this week, the Luftwaffe is at Oshkosh, right? the German Air Force cargo plane. And every time I walk by it this week, I can hear Launchpad. "Have you seen the Luftwaffe at Oshkosh?" I could just, you know, just, I know he would have just loved that so much. I love it. And we'll miss him. So.
I don't have any particularly unique launch pad stories. We've all had the goofy guy with the chocolates walk up to us, right? Who is this guy? And we've all come to know him and love him. That's why we're all here. But I just want to say I'm really thankful for what he did with Potapalooza. Those of you who don't know me or my voice, I'm Pilot Kent from the Pilot Cast. We haven't made new shows in quite a while, but the first Potapalooza was up here at the Forums in 2006. And there were the three of us from the Pilot Cast and Jason Miller from the Finer Points. And then within another year or two, podcasting and aviation got so big that we got the biggest forum and we still couldn't all fit on the stage. And we had UCAP getting, the name of the award slips my mind, the what?
Back seat,
yes. Podcasting had obviously become a big thing. And a few years later, I had gotten to the point where, you know, life was happening and I didn't have enough time to keep Potapalooza going. And I talked to Rod Rakic and David Allen, and they were able to do some of the legwork and get it at Sennheiser there for a couple of years. I'm sure some of you remember. But then one year, you know, David came back to me and said, yeah, I can't really do it either. And it's kept going until now. 100% because of the boundless enthusiasm of Launchpad, who would not let something like this die. So, thank you, Launchpad. One more thing I do want to mention real quick. We lost Mike Anders this year, too. Pilot Mike from the PilotCast. So Grant has put together, we're going to have a brick in the memorial wall. So those of you who want to come on Sunday morning, I believe it's 10 o'clock. So we lost a couple good ones this year. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I know there's been some talk about also possibly chipping in and seeing if we can also do a brick for Launchpad maybe at next year's Air Venture. That's something that I think would be, that I would enjoy, and I think would be something that Launchpad absolutely deserves. So I don't know anything about it, but I'm sure there's Google search terms that will get us started. How much for an acre? This is Launchpad.
At least three.
And those are all for at the Brown Arch.
At the Brown Arch.
Then there's also the memorial wall, which is $500 for a plaque there, and that's okay. The ceremony
between
Mike Andrews.
Okay. So yeah, it's something we don't need to decide here in a group venue, but I know that probably won't be an issue with everyone here because that makes sense. So. This is going to be a stretch. I want to see if anybody wants to try to do a Launchpad impersonation trying to give away a gift. This is a cup. This is a great cup. Ticket number 702. And then we go through about 30 tickets until we find someone to take a cup.
But I think he goes with the numbers much slower.
Yes, he does. Anybody else want to try?
No,
all right.
That was
well, with that, we will all remember Launchpad. He's got a place in my heart forever. And thank you, everyone, for showing up and for Launchpad. Thank you.
Finally, here's my interview with EAA Radio.
But listen, this is going to be a fun quarter hour because we have an old friend of mine, Max Flight, joining us. In fact, as I tell everybody, Max Flight is the geek guy that got me going in podcasting. Gee, how many years ago? I can't even
over
think.
Over 10 years ago.
Yeah,
Rob.
Oh, gosh. And so I co-hosted the Airplane Geeks podcast for a long time. And again, Max was the guy that got me started. So, Max, it is so fun to welcome you to our show.
It's so great to be here. And I haven't seen you in today.
Yeah.
I think EAA Radio and podcasting are kind of like second cousins. You know?
I think so.
A lot of the skills, a lot of the listening habits are similar between the two of them. The difference in podcasting being, of course, that nothing is, well, to generalize here, nothing's ever live, right?
No, in fact, that's something that I remember from early on is that one of the things we would mention to a guest is that, and if you screw up, don't worry, we can just edit it out, just give it a second, and then start over again. And the thing I really liked that I found other people really said about the Airplane Geeks was the production values, because I remember listening, I said, it sounds like a radio show. It really does. It was very well organized, and the mics were all, the sound, everything was great. And I realized that he just kind of learned this stuff on his own. He yeah. knew things because he played with things on the computer side to make the sound what it was. And so we all realized that he was an absolute geek.
Okay, yeah. So the title fits, then that's good. Max, how and why did you decide to start an aviation podcast in 2008?
Well, the honest answer is ego. That's why most people start podcasts, I think, if they're completely honest. But what really happened was I got an email one day in 2008 from someone who I didn't know, someone I had never heard of. It was Courtney Miller, and he said, you know, I have this domain name, airplanegeeks.com, and I have an idea for a podcast. I'm looking for a co-host. Do you want to do that? And I thought, yeah, why not? I said, I don't know anything about podcasting. And he said, you don't need to know. He said, he'll take care of all of the production work. All I needed to do was get a microphone and this free software called Audacity, and we'd get on Skype once a week and have a conversation. And that's literally where it started. But to Rob's point about learning how to do things, Courtney had some life changes, and he was changing jobs. He had a new family. There were many, many good reasons for him to discontinue his adventure in podcasting. And he said, do you want to pick it up and run with it, or we could just cut it here and say it was a fun year? And I said, I'll try to make a go of it. And that's when I talked to Rob Mark, because I knew that I was not going to do a podcast by myself. I am way too boring by myself. I need other people. And, you know, I'm better at asking the questions than answering the questions. So Rob was one of the guys that that joined the crew.
Sure. And we had so much fun that first, really, I guess maybe the second year, because yeah. we're still learning so many things about podcasting, which I still think podcasting is the future. I mean, I know people are focusing on video and all that sort of thing. But if you look at the explosion of podcasting just in the last 18 months, it shows you a real trend. But of course, there's a difference between a podcast and a quality podcast that people will subscribe to. And that is one of the strengths, I think, of why the Airplane Geeks has, let's see, you're at episode
663.
My word. I mean, and we did that religiously every week. There were a few bumps in the way here and there over the 10 years and 11, 12 years, whatever. But it's a lot of work. And we weren't even doing the production work.
Yeah.
Max was doing all that.
So let's talk about your role. This is a loaded question.
That's okay.
Do you feel enough of an aviation geek to actually run this podcast? Or are there times when you go, I don't know? I mean, you talked about getting Rob in as part of your crew.
Well, I love aviation of all forms, which drives the format of the show.
That,
and what we
that
try
was
to
your
accomplish.
Career, right?
That's
when
right.
you were working?
I worked for 35 years for Pratt & Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point saying which location, because lots of locations over the time. I changed careers many, many times within that company. So I got to see different aspects of it, anything from, you know, manufacturing to HR to finance to sales and marketing to legal even. And I had the opportunity during some portions of that career to visit customers, which sometimes was Boeing, sometimes was Airbus, but really was the airlines. And I was fortunate enough to have many, many business trips to Asia, to Europe, the Middle East even, and work with other people who are also passionate about aviation. And that's, you know, the aviation industry, even though it seems huge when you look out over the AirVenture campus here, the event here, it's really a small industry. You run across the same people over and over again. People change careers, people change companies, people change positions, and someone you meet you know, this year, 3 years from now, they may be working in another company doing something completely different.
What do you think, looking back, I know 600 episodes is a long way to go, but do you remember a few that jump out at you? What kind of guests pop into your mind?
Several. Alfred Kahn.
Oh, God, yes.
Right? Mr.
Deregulation.
The father of airline deregulation. He was a guest on the show when he was, because he's passed now, but when he was 90 years old and remains the oldest guest we've ever had. Since I'm talking about age, the youngest guest was, I think, 12. And we've found youngsters. We like to promote aviation,
sure,
amongst younger folks. And we found some really interesting, quite young people that listen to the podcast and are almost certainly going to have a fantastic career in aviation. And we've had them on the show.
You know, it is. I think I'm close on this statistic, but most podcasts don't even last 15 episodes. What do you think is the key to your longevity?
I think continuing – well, two things. Production values. In the beginning of podcasting, people would say in the podcasting community, content is king. Don't worry about anything else. Just make sure the content – yeah, that's good. But if it doesn't sound good, people are not going to continue to listen. So production values is one thing. But we try to make it interesting – to people. Aviation is a very broad topic. All you've got to do is look around outside here and you see a large number of different specialties. People have special interests. And we try to explore those special interests and make them interesting to the broader audience. And having really quality guests, you know, high-level executives typically, others who are, you know, influencers in the industry.
Well, and I think that's a very important point that, you know, finding guests is not easy. We often had to make phone calls and emails and chase people and say, remember, it's tonight, not last night, or, you know, whatever, and then try to generate a few questions like we do here sometimes, just to get the conversation started. And some people are a little tight. You know, they're not too sure what this all is. They're talking to their telephone maybe in the early days, but then once they realize that we were trying to have some fun and educate people, they went, oh yeah, this is kind of cool, and we'd always have a few laughs along the way, and ask some very insightful questions though, because the mail that we would get or the emails kind of showed that, and I think that's an important thing. Is you can have a good quality production podcast, but you've got to figure out a way to keep it going, don't you?
Yes, tell the story.
So there's a lot of technical intensity around UAS and drones. Are you going that direction? Do you think you're going to go more in that direction, less in that direction?
We have gone in that direction. In 2013, was it? We found ourselves talking more and more about unmanned aviation on the show.
Yeah.
And so what we decided to do is spin off another podcast. It's called the UAV Digest. And that's something that I do with David Vanderhoof, who's another co-host on Airplane Geeks. And that's also a weekly show. It's much shorter. It's a 30-minute show. And we focus on unmanned aviation. It's such a big part. And we try to relate it back to manned aviation and things that pilots would be interested in.
So people who are annoyed by drones don't have to listen to them necessarily on your primary podcast.
We try to keep it that way. We try to make that separation. Yes.
It's been a really fun ride on your podcast. And again, I can't imagine how many podcasts the Airplane Geeks has spawned that you may not even know about.
Well, you talk about this in the past tense. I do have one final question.
Okay.
Is it true that Rob left your panel by popular request, or did he just walk out on you?
he abandoned us. No, he had another project, I think, at the time that he had to devote to.
Yeah.
And so, but we still have Rob come on from time to time, as often as we can. We always enjoy having him. He brings... a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge, and that's what I try to do with the different co-hosts is have them kind of, you know, be specialists in certain areas of aviation. So collectively, we know a lot more than we do individually.
Max Flight, one of the founders of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to EAA Radio.
We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and shortly we'll return to our regular format. As always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/664, and you can reach us via email right to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, please join us next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.